So today I'm going to continue with the discussion of orientation. And move on to a discussion of integration. So my hope is to get to Stokes' theorem, which is the fancy manifold theoretic version of Green's theorem that you're probably familiar with, multivariable calculus. And this will help. This will give us a geometric understanding of cohomology. So last time we said that an orientation was a collection of charts so that in different coordinate patches, we have the determinant of the matrix of partial derivatives is positive. So let's give some other ways of looking at what an orientation is. If I have an n form on my manifold, such that omega is never zero, that means that locally, omega looks like function dx1, which dxn, and this function is never zero. Then it gives an orientation. So the orientation is given by saying a collection of coordinates are oriented if in these coordinates if when we write omega is f of x dx1 which dxn, then f is positive. So clearly, if we replace omega by omega times g, where g is a positive function, we get the same orientation. So this is one way to think about what an orientation is. It's a volume, it's a top form, an n form, up to multiplying by a positive function. So let's now think about it in low dimensions, see if we can really get a handle on this. When n is equal to 1, what do we have? I think you're something you're very familiar with. An orientation is just a direction. So here's my one manifold. There's two orientations. I could point that way, or I could point the other way. So an orientation is just an arrow telling us which direction I can move. If n is equal to 2, well, this is a more interesting case. So if we have an orientation, then in coordinates, we select, let's see, dx1 wedge dx2, we choose oriented coordinates, this is going to be compatible with the orientation. dx2 where dx1 is not. So what this is telling us is a kind of choosing an ordering on the coordinates, like first x1, then x2. So we can think of that ordering as like a rotation. This is the x2 direction, the x1 direction. The orientation tells us that we should wind around in this way, counterclockwise, from x1 to x2. So you notice that, for instance, d of minus x2 wedge dx1 is equal to dx1 wedge dx2, because the two minus signs cancel. So we'd expect to move from minus x2 to x1, and that we do. It's x1. Minus x2. So what does this mean? So an orientation in 2D then is a choice of clockwise versus counterclockwise rotation. At each point in my surface, in a way varying continuously. So one more thing you might think about it. At each point in my manifold, you can draw a small circle around it. This. But what an orientation is it's an orientation on that circle. So I mention this because this is an inductive way to think about what an orientation is. In dimension three, suppose we know what two-dimensional orientations are. Then in dimension three, I could say at each point, look at the sphere surrounding that point. An orientation will give an orientation on that sphere, and so on.
Kevin?
Yeah.
What do you mean by an orientation on a sphere? I thought orientation on a circle would be whether clockwise or anti-clockwise, something like that.
That's but right, so the way to think about it, we start by defining what an orientation is on circle. And then on a two-manifold, you say, well, an orientation is at each point, I orient the circle surrounding that point. Mm-hmm. So that allows us to talk about what an orientation is on a sphere. It's at each point on the two-sphere, I orient the circle around. So let me draw a little picture, right? So what's an orientation on a sphere? At each point on the sphere, I choose clockwise or counterclockwise rotation around that point.
So, but in three dimensions, you say that at each point you have to draw a sphere, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and then on that sphere, you have these two-dimensional circles.
Exactly, yeah. So, and then, so this way of looking at it is an inductive definition, where as you go in higher dimensions, it becomes a little less intuitive.
I guess I still don't understand. Like for this 3D case, how you define orientation?
I mean, the shortest way to define orientation is the thing we did in the first, which is to say, I have a collection of coordinate charts where the transition functions have positive Jacobian. But if you want to take this more geometric picture, you'd say, let's suppose we know what it means to orient a two-manifold. That then at each point in my three-sphere, each point in my three-manifold surrounding it is a sphere. An orientation at that point is an orientation on the sphere surrounding it, which I know how to do because I've inductively defined what it means to orient a two-manifold. So I can try and draw a picture. It's like for all points in M, we have a two-sphere surrounding P. So we want at each point in this two-sphere a choice of clockwise versus counterclockwise. And everything should vary continuously. But if you don't find this picture helpful, then going back to this original picture is probably, you could stick with that too. Don't scroll too fast. So how do we get such a thing? So we can ask, is the two-sphere oriented? The answer is yes. Because of the right-hand rule. We take a normal vector n to the two-sphere, which of course we have. By this I just mean the vector passing through the origin. That's a normal vector. And then this is my normal vector n. In the plane orthogonal to it, the right-hand rule from high school electromagnetism tells us how to rotate. But I don't want to get into this right now, but this is a kind of a hint that secretly differential forms are a natural way to talk about the electromagnetic field. I mean, especially the magnetic field. But let's not get into that right now. Okay, so more generally, if I take some surface in R3, an orientation is the same thing as a consistent choice of normal vector. So let's look at an example that is not oriented. Mobius band is not oriented. To see this, one way to see it is that there is no consistent normal vector. If you think about it, what do we mean by a normal vector? I have a surface. That's a choice of like saying, it's a choice between the two sides. This side is inside, that side is outside. Right? This is the top, that's the bottom. So saying the Mobius band is no consistent normal vector is the same thing as saying it only has one side. Or alternatively, we can just draw this picture. Or I've identified the top and the bottom with a twist. And then we can think, can we draw a consistent orientation? So I can consistent choice of clockwise or counterclockwise. Let's start in the middle and do one choice, so we'll go that way. And as I reach the top, you find that because I'm identifying the two things with a flip, it comes out going the other way. So it's not consistent. Okay. Any questions about that? So let's give another example of a manifold which is not oriented. This is a manifold Giuseppe explained. It's ORP2. It's the set of lines through the origin. Or alternatively, you know, every line through the origin intersects the sphere at two points, and those two points are antipodal. So it's the set of points x in the t-sphere, where I identify x with minus x. So I identify two antipodal points. So to understand why this is not oriented, we want to see that this contains a Mobius band. So anything which contains a Mobius band cannot be oriented, cannot have an orientation. And in fact, the converse is true. A two-dimensional manifold is oriented if and only if it does not have any Mobius bands in it. Let's see why this contains a Mobius band. So I'm taking this sphere and I'm identifying antipodal points. So I can take the region in the sphere where x1, let's see, here's x1 equals minus epsilon. There's a circle, this kind of thing. So I'm going to think of it like this. I'm going to strip off part of the bottom hemisphere and say it's like a disc and this band. But there's some redundancy in this description. So the only, I still have to identify antipodal points, and the only antipodal points that can appear are those which are on the band. So let's think about what that means. So I'm going to give this coordinates like that's x1, and the angular coordinate is theta. So what are two antipodal points? So this point here is going to be identified with that point there. It's going to be tricky to draw if I go, you might have this point here. It's going to be identified with that point there, and so on. So it's really, there's going to be something in the interior of the band too, for instance. Go down a little bit, I'll go up a little bit there. So you notice that if two points are antipodal, their angle differs by pi. So the identification is x1 theta is equivalent to minus x1 theta plus pi. And this is exactly the Mobius band. So we see that this manifold contains a Mobius band and therefore does not have a consistent orientation. So if you think about this a little more, you realize that 4P2 is equal to a disk, or I sew it onto a Mobius band, because the boundary of the Mobius band is a circle. You draw that. You take this picture of a Mobius band, you can just see, if you think about it as having no interior, it's just a black line I drew, that's just a circle. So you could imagine trying to glue a disk to that circle, and this will give you orb2. But it's not possible to actually do that in three dimensions. Okay, any questions? Okay, so the next thing I wanted to discuss was integration. So the first thing is, let's work locally on some coordinate patch. We take omega to be an n form, and I'm going to take or inside some coordinate patch, use my coordinate patch, and or is going to be some bounded region. So then, if xi, yi, are oriented coordinates on this region. Then what we're going to find, just kind of obvious now, I think, is that the integral of my form over this region is independent of the coordinates. So to see this, we can write omega is f of x, x1, xn, and that's, you can also write it in g of y, dy1, yn, and then the integral over this region of f dx1 dxn is the integral of the same region. And the reason is simply because dy1 wedge dyn is equal to the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. Since this is positive, this determinant is positive, we also have it's equal to the absolute value of the determinant. And the absolute value is what appears in the change of variables formulation formula for integration. So we're going to, so the idea to integrate on a global manifold is cut your manifold into pieces. On each piece, perform this integral and then just sum the pieces up. It's going to be convenient to take our pieces to be cubes. So for example, we take coordinates x, I, y, I, then let me just write it like this. X, I is some function of the y's. I'll call this h, just to make explicit its dependence on y's. So the integral, I want to consider the integral over a cube like this. And the statement above is that we can compute this in x coordinates or y coordinates, and we get the same answer. But in y coordinates, we have to be careful that we're integrating over the same region. Integral where h I of y 0 to 1 so the region we're integrating over is the same, we're just describing it in a slightly different way, these different coordinates. Now, let's consider a more global case. M is a global manifold. Which I want to assume is, you know, finite in extent, because I don't want to be too worried that integrals converge. I want to make sure my integrals converge automatically. And we can cut M up into cubes. It's always possible to do this. Go like this. For each cube, lives in the coordinate hash. Say, we can assume that there are finitely many cubes. Then we can define for each cube and if I have an n form omega, since each cube lives in a single coordinate patch, the integral over the cube omega makes sense and it doesn't require a choice of coordinates, so it's independent of coordinates. And again, as long as our coordinates are all compatible with the orientation. So of course I'm asking oriented. So if there are n cubes, we say the integral over m of my n form is, let's call this k. It's just the sum of the integrals over each cube. And to make sure that this makes sense, if we chose a different way of dividing m up, well, why do we get the same answer? And we see this. We can consider the integral over the intersections. Let me draw a little picture. Suppose one set of cubes looks like this. Another might look like that or something. What we're going to do is consider the integrals over the intersections, which are these little regions. And as is clear from the picture, the sum, if I take the sum over I and j, this guy, if I sum over I after summing over j, well, the sum over j just collects the pieces of the intersection lying in a single cube with index I. So this sum over j is just going to be the integral over ci. And similarly, by sum of the different order, that's going to be some j equals cj. cj prime. So just by thinking about these kind of elementary considerations, like all we've really used was the transformation formula for integrals and the fact that on different patches, the Jacobian matrix, the determinant of the Jacobian is positive. Once we have that, we can define integration by cutting our manifold up into pieces and integrating on each piece. And we find that the result is independent of how we cut it up by some simple argument like this. Okay. Any questions about this so far?
I have a question. I guess I'm not exactly clear how this integration map works. Like, we're going from n forms, presumably, to some function on R. I couldn't tell you what I do with a wedge product when I have like dx1, wedge dx2, and so on. Like, how do I interpret that when I actually want to do a calculation?
Right. So, you, like, if you want to do an explicit calculation, you're going to choose coordinates on your manifold, and then you write your n form. It's going to look like, in these coordinates, some function dx1 to dxn. And then we're doing just the usual integration f over some region. Like, suppose I wanted to do an integral over the two sphere. So what you could do is you could say, well, you know, you don't have really great global coordinates on the two sphere. So you might choose two patches. Say when x 3 is positive, or when x3 is negative, on each patch, the coordinates are x1, x2, with x1 squared plus x2 squared less than or equal to 1. So on each patch, you're integrating over a disk on the plane. So your total integral will be a sum of two contributions, each of which is just an integral over a disk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, so if I'm understanding, the integral of gx1 wedge dx2, do I just and I'm integrating over some region on R2, do I just interpret that as the integral of dx1, dx2?
Yes. Exactly. So it's just like a double integral. And you can first integrate over x1 and then integrate over x2. You know, maybe.
But why couldn't I just swap the order of integration? Like, if it's just over this a square region in the plane, order of integration. At the one form level, that would induce a sign, but at this level, it wouldn't.
If you swap the order?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some things which are tied up with conventions, right? So even at the one form level, if you're, you know, when you learned in high school what an integral was like a sum. And then, but that was always, that didn't really depend on the order. The integral from 0 to 1 and the integral from 1 to 0 were the same thing if you view them as a sum. So there's, I think there's some similar kind of convention stuff going on here. So the rule, as I think about it, is you choose oriented coordinates. Say x1, x2. And then write, you write it as f dx1 dx2. And then the integral means something like a Lebesgue integral or Riemann integral. So it's like it's a sum. It's really a limit of sums. So it's something that if my function is positive, will give me a positive answer. You know, you cut up your square into tiny squares of size epsilon, take the value of your function on that square and multiply by the area of that square and sum it and send epsilon to zero.
Yeah, exactly. When we define something as the Riemann or Lebesgue integral, then that means, I think the question is that you have these Fubini theorems where you can say that you can do one integral first and integrate the next. And so that order of integration, does that have anything to do with the positions dx, dx2? Because if it has, then in those theorems, it says that the integral is not, whereas in here, we'll pick a minus sign.
That's okay. This is a good question. So, like in the classic Fubini theorems, there is no sign. So you can ask. In this example, I choose my oriented coordinates x1 and x2, and then the integral is this double integral, f dx1 dx2. It's just the product. Is equal to think given by Fubini. Let's assume f is constant or something like that. Let's see. Yeah, I don't know what to say. What was it?
Can I try to provide an answer? I think I have an idea of why this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem is that the notation with double integrals in Rn implicitly has an orientation in the domain. Whenever you write the integral on the circle, for example, on the disk, you are implicitly assuming when you write integral over the disk that the disk has the standard orientation that it gets from R2. So then when you write dx1, dx2, and if you swap them, you write dx2, dx1, it doesn't matter. Well, when we're doing things in differential geometry, the orientation is not in the set. The orientation is in the form. And therefore, we have the wedge, and it matters whether we swap them and we get the minus sign. At least that's the way I usually think about it.
Maybe I could say like in a different way, right? So when I was doing this, I chose oriented coordinates x1 and x2. And then I used the Lebesgue measure. But suppose I had a different orientation. Given by where the oriented coordinates were x2, x1 were oriented coordinates. Then the rules are, you write omega as f dx2 wedge dx1, because these are my oriented coordinates. So g, and then perform the Lebesgue integral. And the Lebesgue integral has no signs in it. It's always positive. But of course, because if omega was f dx1 dx2, then g is minus f. So if I chose a different orientation, I would pick up a sign.
Yeah, but it's, I see here, but the issue is the problem we're facing, or at least what's not clear is once you go in the integral in the sense of Riemann or Lyapunov method, at that level, dx2, dx1, and dx1, dx2 does not produce a sign.
Exactly. Once you move, because really, so the Riemann or Lyapunov integral, that's something where you find the absolute value of the Jacobian factor without any sign. So there, in the Riemann-Lyapunov thing, there's some kind of, like the symbol we use for differential forms does not transform exactly the same as the volume form in the Riemann-Lyapunov integral.
So the structure of the wedge product is necessary here, like to define integration because of the orientation itself, right? Because if we didn't have orientation, then we couldn't define like properly the concept of integration.
No, you can define the concept of integration in general. Like suppose I have a Mobius band. Let's just be really naive and say, well, look, I just cut my Mobius band up into little squares. Take the area of the square, the value of my function on it, and take a limit as the size of the squares gets small. So it is possible to define integration on non-oriented manifolds. The thing is that the things you naturally integrate are not forms, because forms transform in the wrong way. There's a concept of a density. So in general, what you naturally integrate is a density. Which transforms by the absolute value of the determinant. So there's always a theory of integration for densities, but an orientation is the same as a way to identify forms with like n forms of densities. Okay. I'd like to try to move on to quickly to Stokes' theorem. If that's okay. So firstly, if M has boundary, and N is the boundary of M, then an orientation on M gives one on N. Because in coordinates, when I take x1 to xn, and n is the region x1 equals 0, and x1 takes positive values on m, if dx1, dxn, this is like an oriented volume form, that is, it produces positive measure, we declare minus dx2 dxn to be oriented on n. So the minus is a convention, but you choose this convention to make Stokes' theorem nice. I take some n minus one form of m, the integral over m of d omega is equal to the integral n. This is Stokes' theorem. So I hope this is, it's a very simple formulation, but it might be familiar, you know, if m was of dimension one, this is integration by parts. If m is of dimension two or three, there's Green's theorem in the plane, Green's theorem in space.
Kevin, just why minus sign? What? Why did the orientation? Why do we have that extra minus sign? Which part of this?
Yeah. We'll see this when, let's look at the case when m is of dimension one. So m is an integral with coordinates 0, 1. And the boundary of m is 0 union, it's 2 points. Let's look at the orientation. So dx is an oriented one form. So when, because x takes values between 0 and 1, we look back at our sign, we find an extra minus sign there. So the point 0 has a negative orientation. The point 1, because x takes value less than one, we pick up a different sign. So to do the same thing for the point one, I need to choose coordinates where near the point one, the boundary is at the region at zero. Here we can choose coordinates y to be 1 minus x, and then dy minus dy is a positive one form, like an oriented one form, so that by the conventions, the point 1 has positive orientation. Okay, now let's look at the integral. Let's look at Stokes' theorem. Integral of df so with the f of 1 minus f of 0 are treated with different signs for this reason. And that was the reason for this convention. So the proof of Stokes' theorem is really quite easy. First step, work on a cube. Where we have coordinates xi, and I'm going to be integrating over the region where these are between 0 and 1. I'll write omega . So omega is an n minus one form, so it's missing one index. So I'm gonna write it like this to keep the notation clean. So d omega omega looks like this. And what we want is that the integral is equal to, well, this should be the integral over the boundary of the cube. What's the boundary of the cube? Well, that's when one of the coordinates takes value 0 or one of the coordinates takes value 1. X I equals, I'm going to remove this guy. Well, you know what I mean. That's gone. Is omega where x I is equal to 1 minus omega where x I is equal to 0. So maybe you can see easier in the case of a square, the boundary consists of those four regions and they appear with different signs. Now, if we go back to what omega is, it's kind of obvious that this is true by Fubini's theorem, integration by parts. So the contribution from minus 1 to the I df dx I dx1 by dxn is I integration by parts minus 1 to the I integral over x1, skip xi, xn, omega at xi equals 1 minus omega at xi equals 0. So we clearly get the right answer, but we have to think a little bit about this sign. So this should be minus 1 to the I plus 1, minus 1 to the I. So y minus 1 to the I plus 1, it has to do with the orientation on the boundary. So on the boundary, where, say, x I is 0, well, we want to put it in the form we used before. So dx1, which dxn, is an oriented folding form. So minus 1 to the I plus 1, dxi, which dx1, dxi hat, dxn, is an oriented folding form. Applies the band on the boundary. I'm going to pick up yet another sign, minus 1 to the I, dx1, dx I hat, dxn is an oriented form. So carefully tracing through our conventions for how we orient the boundary gives us the correct signs. So in other words, if I just look at the formula for involving the Lebesgue integral, there wasn't any signs except for the difference between 1 and 0. But the signs appearing next to DFDXI and the signs appearing to do with the orientation kind of cancel. So okay, so I think I'll stop there. So we've done the initial case of Stokes' theorem, which is a cube, and the remaining case is just think of your manifold as built from cubes and do the same argument.